You are now listening to the OrthoBullets podcast.
This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of exercise science from the sports section on orthobullets.com. And FYI, this is the second most commonly tested topic in the sports category after ACL tears. So to start off this discussion about exercise science, let's review the different types of contractions slash movements. The first one is an isotonic contraction, which describes constant muscle tension as a muscle changes length, and as you would think, isotonic muscle contractions improve motor performance. There are two examples of isotonic contractions, concentric and eccentric. A concentric contraction is a type of isotonic muscle contraction in which the muscles shorten while generating force. And an example of this is your classic bicep curl with the elbow flexing. During an eccentric contraction, the muscle elongates while under tension due to an opposing force being greater than the force generated by the muscle, and this is considered the most efficient method of muscle strengthening. Think of a negative rep for eccentric contraction. Think a bicep curl with the elbow extending instead of flexing like in concentric muscle contractions. An isometric contraction is defined as constant muscle length and tension that is proportional to the external load, and this will cause muscle hypertrophy. An example of an isometric contraction is pushing against an immovable object. An isokinetic contraction is characterized by constant speed despite variable effort. So an isokinetic exercise is performed with a specialized apparatus that provides variable resistance to a movement so that no matter how much effort is exerted, the movement takes place at a constant speed. This type of exercise is used to test and improve muscular strength and endurance, especially after injury. It's often used to objectively evaluate muscle strength during injury rehabilitation. An isokinetic exercise requires special machines, for example, a Cybex machine. Plyometric activity is characterized by rapid eccentric concentric shortening, and this is great training for sports that require power. An example of plyometric activity is box jumps. Now let's talk about open chain versus closed chain movements. Open chain exercises are movements where the end of the kinetic chain is moving freely and not fixed to the floor or a wall. Leg extensions and leg curls are examples of open chain exercises. These are also examples of isotonic contractions, which we just discussed, and remember they are defined by a constant muscle contraction throughout the range of motion. Closed chain exercises are movements where the distal end of the extremity is fixed, so squats with a planted foot or a seated leg press are examples of a closed chain exercise. Closed chain rehabilitation is emphasized in the early stages of ACL reconstruction rehabilitation because it allows physiologic co-contraction of the musculature around the knee. This is believed to decrease shear forces across the ACL reconstruction, whereas open chain exercises can increase the shear stresses. Now, let's talk about the differences between anaerobic, glycolytic, and aerobic activity with respect to energy sources used, muscle types involved, and the exercise duration associated with each. So anaerobic metabolism uses the ATP creatine phosphate system for its energy source. Type 2 or fast twitch muscles are associated with anaerobic activity. And as far as exercise duration for anaerobic metabolism, it's typically associated with 10 seconds of high intensity, so sprinting is an example of this. And just a quick note about type 2 muscles, type 2A muscles can be either aerobic or anaerobic, while type 2B muscles are primarily anaerobic. Type 2 muscles typically have a high strength of contraction and high speed of contraction, where there's a large force generation per cross-sectional area, and these muscles typically fatigue rapidly. Glycolytic metabolism uses lactic acid as its energy source, and glycolytic exercise duration is usually 2 to 3 minutes. Glycolytic metabolism has a low ATP yield, and you will go into lactic acidosis after several minutes. Finally, aerobic metabolism uses oxidative phosphorylation via the Krebs cycle for its energy source. Type 1 or slow twitch muscles are aerobic, and as far as exercise duration, these muscles are designed for endurance, like distance running. Unlike type 2 fast twitch muscles, they have low strength of contraction as well as low speed of contraction, and they are the first to atrophy with deconditioning. Remember that aerobic metabolism has a high ATP yield, unlike glycolytic metabolism, and also remember that it requires oxygen. So if it helps you remember, think of the mnemonic 1 slow red ox, which means type 1 muscles are slow twitch, red, and use oxidative metabolism. Now, let's go over some important exercise program definitions that have been tested in the past. The first term is periodization, which refers to a planned variation in intensity and duration of a specific workout over a predefined duration of time. So, for example, a distance runner training for an upcoming marathon uses periodization as a conditioning method by changing the length in miles and intensity measured in speed during training sessions before competition. The ultimate goal of periodization is obtaining maximal performance based on the concept of progressive overload, one at which conditioning is started at moderate tolerable levels of exertion and progressively pushed to maximum exertion. Periodization cycles are defined by length of time and are referred to as macrocycles, mesocycles, or microcycles. Macrocycles generally refer to an entire training year. Mesocycles are 3 to 6 months, and microcycles are 3 to 6 weeks. Multiple variables can be adjusted during a cycle in addition to intensity and duration of a conditioning workout. They can include variation in types of exercises or length of rest periods between exercises. The AAOS consensus statement reports that periodization is superior to training techniques in which intensity and duration of training are kept constant over a given period of time. They describe specific periodization programs and also review other aspects such as sport-specific training and progressive overload. Now, moving on to the term dynamic exercise. And all you really need to know about this is that it improves cardiac output by increasing cardiac stroke volume. The definition of cardiac output is heart rate times stroke volume. Therefore, increasing the stroke volume, which is the amount of blood pumped by the heart with each contraction, does increase the cardiac output. Training usually results in a decreased resting heart rate, and while training can increase your red blood cell mass and VO2 max, otherwise known as aerobic capacity, they do not affect cardiac output. According to Vella et al., for endurance-trained subjects, the proposed mechanisms for the progressive increase in stroke volume to VO2 max are enhanced diastolic filling, enhanced contractility, larger blood volume, and decreased cardiac afterload. The next term is endurance or aerobic training, which we kind of briefly talked about already. But endurance training results in changes in circulation and muscle metabolism. With endurance training, contractile muscle adapts by increasing energy efficiency. It also increases mitochondrial size, number, and density. It increases in enzymes involved in the Krebs cycle, fatty acid processing, and the respiratory chain. Over time, with endurance training, there's an increased use of fatty acids more than glycogen. Also over time, the oxidative capacity of type 1, 2A, and 2B fibers increase with endurance training, and specifically the percentage of more highly oxygenated 2A fibers increases. There's a term called the aerobic threshold, which is the level of effort at which anaerobic energy pathways become significant energy producers. Anaerobic or lactate threshold, on the other hand, is the level of effort at which lactate production is greater than lactate removal. Moving on to strength training, this typically involves high-load, low-repetition activities, and subsequently results in increased cross-sectional area of muscle due to muscle hypertrophy. Hyperplasia or increased number of muscle fibers is less likely. Strength training results in increased motor unit recruitment plus or minus improved synchronization of muscle activity. And remember that maximal force production is proportional to the muscle's physiologic cross-sectional area. Now, just a quick word about adolescence and weight training. It was previously thought that children and adolescents should avoid strength training or plyometric, that is, rapid eccentric concentric shortening exercise programs for a variety of reasons, including concern for physeal injury and growth disturbance, increasing the risk of injury during other sporting activities, and inability to derive strength gains. New studies have shown, however, when participating in an age-appropriate fitness program, adolescents can safely achieve strength and conditioning gains beyond expected normal developmental gains from age. It is believed these gains are likely related to neuromuscular improvements in activation and coordination, rather than muscle hypertrophy. An age-appropriate fitness program will limit the risk to the adolescent by appropriately limiting the amount of weight and number of repetitions being performed. Guy et al. Did a review of current concepts in strength training for children and adolescents. They note that gains in strength and coordination can be seen and are reversible if the training is discontinued. They report that the risk of injury is no different for adolescent athletes who participate in these types of programs compared to those who do not. Moving on to aquatic training, exercises in water can minimize joint stress by decreasing the vertical component of the ground reaction forces through buoyancy. Furthermore, they are believed to prevent secondary injuries of the lower limb joints through improved balance and muscle control. In addition, it's been found that aquatic exercises can be beneficial to the cardiorespiratory system by preventing abrupt increases in heart rate and by requiring greater oxygen consumption than equivalent exercises on the land. Miyoshi et al. Quantified the ankle, knee, and hip joint moments during walking in water in comparison with those on land with the use of a video motion analysis system in 8 healthy volunteers who walked at a speed comfortable for them. They concluded that walking in water could be designed to incorporate large muscle activities, especially lower limb extensor muscles, through the full range of joint motion while minimizing joint movements. Moving on to exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction, or EILO. This is commonly mistaken for exercise-induced bronchoconstriction in athletes. As far as the epidemiology, it tends to be more common in females. The mechanism is unknown, and the symptoms include dyspnea and wheezing. Differential diagnosis for exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction include exercise-induced bronchoconstriction, otherwise known as exercise-induced asthma, hyperventilation, and certain cardiac conditions. As far as diagnosis, if a patient has a positive bronchoprovocation test, which include things like the methacholine challenge, the mannitol challenge, or a eucapnic voluntary hyperventilation test, they have exercise-induced bronchoconstriction. If they have a negative bronchoprovocation test, they have exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction. If a patient has a positive bronchodilator reversibility test, which is done with a beta-2 agonist, they have exercise-induced bronchoconstriction. If a patient has a negative bronchodilator reversibility test, they have exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction. If a patient has a positive continuous laryngoscopy during exercise, or CLE, they have exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction. If they have a negative continuous laryngoscopy during exercise, they have exercise-induced bronchoconstriction. So again, if a patient has a negative bronchoprovocation test and a bronchodilator reversibility test, as well as a positive continuous laryngoscopy during exercise, the patient has exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction. There's a poor correlation between asthma-like symptoms and evidence of exercise-induced bronchoconstriction. Many athletes are diagnosed with exercise-induced bronchoconstriction have little evidence to support this diagnosis because many conditions that mimic asthma also produce a wheeze and dyspnea from temporary obstruction at the level of the larynx. The term exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction describes this and includes exercise-induced laryngomalacia and vocal cord dysfunction. It's a spectrum of disease ranging from mild cross-sectional area decrease at the laryngeal inlet to complete obstruction from the supraglottic level, which includes the arytenoids and supporting structures, to the glottic level, which includes the vocal cords. The gold standard for diagnosis is continuous laryngoscopy during exercise. Nielsen et al. Retrospectively reviewed 88 athletes worked up for asthma with continuous laryngoscopy during exercise. They found that 35% of patients had exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction. Specifically, 23% had exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction, 26% had asthma, 12.5% had both asthma and exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction, and 39% had neither. In each group, approximately 60% were on asthma medication. They concluded that exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction is prevalent in athletes and an important differential diagnosis. It can mimic asthma and is not discernible by clinical appraisal alone. Eichenberger et al. Performed a systematic review to evaluate the effect of exercise on airway hyperreactivity in asthma. They found 17 studies involving 599 patients. They found that exercise improved quality of life, bronchial hyperresponsiveness, exercise-induced bronchoconstriction, and FEV1 compared with control conditions. They recommend exercise as supplementary therapy to medication. The overall optimum treatment for exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction is currently being investigated. Moving on to weight training, the effect of weight training on muscles includes increased cross-sectional area, increased strength, increased mitochondria, increased capillary density, and thickened connective tissue. Adult strength gains are associated with muscle hypertrophy, while adolescent strength gains, remember, occur more from increased muscle firing efficiency and coordination. Moving on to nutritional training, carbohydrate loading is a strategy that involves changes to training and nutrition which can maximize muscle glycogen stores prior to endurance exercise lasting longer than 90 minutes. There continues to be varying scientific opinions as to whether athletes should eat low versus high glycemic index foods and how this will affect the amount that the serum glucose levels rise. Fructose is able to be converted to glycogen in the liver, but not muscle. Therefore, high fructose-containing foods are suboptimal. This practice is recommended for athletes participating in events that are longer than 90 minutes, which is after the body's normal supply of glycogen is depleted. Coyle et al. Analyzed 10 trained cyclists who performed two bicycle ergometer exercise tests 1 week apart. They found that blood glucose concentration was 20 to 40% higher during the exercise after carbohydrate ingestion than during the exercise without carbohydrate feeding. The exercise-induced decrease in plasma insulin was prevented by carbohydrate feeding. Ultimately, fatigue was postponed by carbohydrate feeding during exercise in 7 out of the 10 subjects. Costile et al. Examined the effect of carbohydrates on muscle glycogen resynthesis in trained runners and found that muscle glycogen levels could be normalized with the proper use of carbohydrates after strenuous activity. Sherman et al. Used muscle biopsies to determine the effects of moderate or high carbohydrate diets on muscle glycogen and performance in runners and cyclists over 7 consecutive days of training. They found that a high carbohydrate diet restored muscle glycogen to more normal levels than a moderate carbohydrate diet, but did not find any difference in the effect on performance. Now, let's talk about fluid loading and replacement. The magnitude of the core temperature and the heart rate increase accompanying work are proportional to the magnitude of water debt at the onset of exercise. The best technique is to replace enough water to maintain pre-practice weight. As far as fluid, carbohydrate, and electrolyte replacement, this is best done with low osmolarity fluids of carbohydrates and electrolytes, which enhances absorption in the gut. And the osmolarity of these fluids are usually less than 10%. And remember that glucose polymers decrease the osmolarity. Now, let's talk about muscle injury. We'll start from the benign end of the spectrum with muscle soreness, which is caused by edema and inflammation in the connective tissue that leads to increased intramuscular pressure. And this occurs primarily in type 2B fibers. And soreness tends to be the worst with unaccustomed eccentric exercise. Delayed onset muscle soreness, or DOMS, typically peaks at 24 to 72 hours and is associated with elevated creatine kinase levels in the serum. A muscle strain commonly occurs at the myotendinous junction, and this often occurs during eccentric contraction, which produces the highest forces in skeletal muscle. The pathoanatomy of a muscle strain is basically inflammation followed by fibrosis. A muscle contusion is a non-penetrating blunt injury that leads to hematoma and inflammation. Extracellular connective tissue forms within 2 days and peaks between 5 to 21 days. Healing is characterized by late scar formation and variable muscle regeneration. Myositis ossificans, or bone formation within the muscle tissue, is most apparent 4 weeks post-injury. Finally, muscle laceration, or a complete tear of the muscle, typically occurs near the myotendinous junction and is characterized by abnormal muscle contour. The muscle fragments heal by dense connective scar tissue, and this is mediated by myofibroblasts. Once laceration of skeletal muscle has occurred, regeneration and reinnervation is unpredictable. Regeneration may occur within 7 to 10 days after injury. This process is facilitated by the cytokines IGF-1, FGF, and NGF. At the same time, fibrous scar tissue forms to bridge the lacerated muscle segments. This process is mediated by TGF-beta, which stimulates the differentiation and proliferation of myofibroblasts. For muscle injuries, including partial lacerations, current literature suggests the affected extremity should be immobilized no more than 3 to 5 days, followed by a progressive strengthening and stretching program. Healing and muscle injury involves two competing processes: regeneration of muscle fibers and formation of granulation tissue. Starting motion too soon after injury may increase the area of fiber scar and limit the ability of new muscle fibers to penetrate this area. Prolonged immobilization limits scar production, but penetrating muscle fibers will lack appropriate orientation, and the muscle as a whole begins to atrophy. 3 to 5 days of immobilization has been shown to limit scar tissue production, while the early motion helps generate appropriately organized muscle fibers and maintain strength as well as range of motion. So the major points about muscle immobilization is that it can result in shorter muscle position and atrophy, it leads to decreased ability to generate tension, and it's also associated with increased fatigability, it results in fatty infiltration, remember that atrophy occurs faster in muscles crossing a single joint, and atrophy occurs at a nonlinear rate. Most changes occur during the initial days of disuse. And it's interesting to note that loss of myofibrils within the muscle fibers are actually seen at the cellular level. And remember that the level of atrophy is related to the duration of immobilization. Another important point is that atrophy is more prominent if immobilization occurs without tension. For example, quadriceps atrophy is greater than hamstring atrophy with knee immobilization and extension. As far as some treatment principles for exercise-related injuries, local treatments are designed to assist with soft tissue recovery or rehabilitation. Goals of treatment include decreased inflammation, increased local blood flow, and increased tissue compliance. Modalities include cryo or heat treatments, massage, ultrasound, electrical stimulation, and iontophoresis, which is the use of an electrical current to drive charged molecules of medicine through the skin to the deep tissues. When ultrasound rather than electrical current is used to deliver medicine, it's called phonophoresis. Medications that are used in iontophoresis or phonophoresis include steroids, local anesthetics, salicylates, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Contraindications to iontophoresis include a hypersensitivity / allergy to the drug being used and susceptibility to applied currents, like patients with cardiac pacemakers, for example. Now let's finish this review with the indications for iontophoresis and the drugs / solutions used to treat them. Hyperhidrosis is treated with tap water or glycopyrrolate. Muscle spasm is treated with magnesium sulfate or calcium chloride. Edema is treated with hyaluronidase. Adhesive conditions are treated with iodine. Inflammation is treated with dexamethasone, hydrocortisone, prednisone, lidocaine, or salicylates. Calcific tendonitis and myositis ossificans can be treated with acetic acid. And open wounds are treated with zinc oxide or telazoline hydrochloride. That's all for this review about exercise science. Hopefully that was helpful. Look out for questions related to this topic on this weekend's question session, and hopefully this episode will have prepared you for that review. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It'll help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.